Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. What a great opening opportunity to make the link between the framework, the theoretical framework, and an attempt, at least in the early stages, of putting it into practice. Before I open into the presentation, I should just confirm I have no conflicts of interest, no financial interests that I need to declare today. But what I want to try and do in this presentation is demonstrate how we're trying to funnel the global framework that Ehud has so neatly expressed into a world regional model, into a country model, into a particular organisational approach that the Faculty of Public Health in the UK has developed over the last 12 months, and then John will then help feed that back out into what the Faculty of Public Health in the UK is trying to achieve globally. So that's what we're going to do in 20 minutes. Okay? So bear with me. The global framework that Ehud has explained, I don't need to go back through this, he's already picked up quite a lot of this. It comes from existing regional frameworks which are well established, and it's been drawn together from these different frameworks. But it was because there was a fragmentation to service development, to misunderstandings, missed opportunities, that there was a need recognised to develop a global model. So the opportunity here is to foster some global dialogue, understand public health, and assist in workforce development. The model itself is a really helpful overview of just seven aspects that I think if we can hold on to as we go through the presentation, it will help in terms of this funneling down and this building back up again. In Europe, the European Public Health Association has just recently completed its strategic review. It talks about a vision of improving health and well-being, narrowing health inequalities for all Europeans. I've highlighted in its mission statement here some critical phrases which ring true in terms of the global framework. To be a leading scientific and independent voice. They're talking here clearly about advocacy. To build capacity, knowledge in the field of public health and health services, and to support practice and policy decisions through scientific evidence. The strategic objectives that they've picked out focus on capacity building, knowledge building, policy building, and they bridge all of that into their four pillars of research, policy, practice, training and education. If we just go back up, you can see that they are all part of this global model. They all fit together with that model. Now, in the 20 years I've spent working in the voluntary sector across the UK, I've done training in project management and program management and in strategic management design. You can cut this stuff 27 million different ways. What strikes me about this is an opportunity to focus on seven core areas of public health engagement work and have a common vocabulary that we can all use and adopt at a very simple, straightforward level. We can cut into that in lots of different levels of detail, but if we're all still working into that framework, it gives us that common language. And that seems to me to be what Europe has done. And if I show you the pictorial for the UEFA strategic map, you can see in the top left, be a leading scientific voice in public health, being a voice. On the right, building capacity and knowledge. At the bottom, investing in future generations. It's a capacity building piece. Voicing knowledge, enhancing capacity. This is their pictorial. I don't think that they actually pulled this from the previous piece, from this model. Otherwise, they'd just have copied it. They'd just use it identically. What they've done is they've identified this independently almost, and all I'm trying to do is align that common voice at a global, regional and UK level. So that's the UEFA strategic map, and that's part of their strategic plan for the next 5 years. However, in the UK, I'm very new to public health, I've only been in post 12 months, but in the UK, what we could identify very quickly is that there are some significant weaknesses in our system. It's still very fragmented. There's been huge amounts of political interference. There's continuous structural reform going on. But we have a relatively strong system, and it's been a base of models that's been adopted across the Commonwealth and globally. But with this continuous reform, with financial pressures, with other challenges such as Ebola, which I hope John will talk more about in a moment, it's generated lots of gaps in the UK. And we actually have ended up with the silos that our previous colleagues have talked a lot about across about 20 different public health organisations that operate just within the UK. So what we've done is we've said jointly, the Faculty of Public Health, along with the Association of Directors of Public Health, which are the lead body for regional directorships in public health, what we said is let's call a summit of all those bodies together, the presidents and chief execs of all those agencies, to have a conversation about what we might collectively commit to doing and how we might, just within the UK, talk in a common language. And the four key areas that came up were advocacy, promotion, knowledge, workforce. We wanted to develop this common agenda for collaboration. Lo and behold, they loved this model. This was 5 weeks ago. Okay, this took place, this meeting took place. 5 weeks ago. The only comment that they made about the model was that it felt a little introspective. And what they said they would have preferred to see diagrammatically that would have pleased them was a whole bunch of arrows pointing outwards, saying this is about external partnership, external engagement. It's not all about just looking at ourselves all the time. This is about how we produce and promote ourselves in the external world. So at a UK level, we've now got these organisations from all four countries in the UK coming together and saying, OK, that's great, we understand all the models, what are we actually going to do as a result of that? And we're developing an action plan for all those organisations to just pick up two or three very simple, clear things that we can do on advocacy. I'll give you an example of that. The first is we're going to produce a common manifesto for the elections which take place next year. We're going to produce a first 100 days paper. What should the incoming government be doing around public health, which the entire sector is going to collaborate on, come together on, and all talk about in a collective voice, based on this sort of common understanding that the framework gives them. At the faculty end, so for my organisation, which is, as Manjushri said, is a faculty of the three Royal Colleges of Physicians in the UK, we've done our own strategy developments, what I've spent the last 12 months doing. What did we understand and develop as we were going along? Well, we picked out four priority areas and four enabler areas. Our priorities were advocacy, workforce, standards and knowledge. And what we've said, the reason these arrows cut across from left to right, across the enablers, membership, partnership, profile and global health, is that each aspect of this work operates across all the enablers. I won't go into too many examples, but you could see how, in terms of advocacy, we advocate for our members, we advocate in collaboration with our partners, we advocate to improve the profile not just of the Faculty of Public Health, but of public health itself, and of the kind of things it stands for, and the values that it brings, and we advocate on global health issues. So it cuts right across. This is just a 2D. And similarly, at an enabler point, you could see how our membership is absolutely central to delivering all four of our priorities. They're going to be our advocates. We're developing special interest groups for them to play in, to be our advocates, to be our press spokespeople. They're involved in developing our workforce. They plan and set the curriculum. They set the standards for the curriculum for consultancy training across the UK. And we're also involved in them supporting the knowledge, not just through the evidence base that they develop through their research, but through the sharing of that through networks and through collaborations of their own that they will have across 3,500 members that we have in the UK. But you can see again, we're talking about exactly the same kind of model. At a UK level, we've got a 20-body organisation that's talking around governance. We're looking at information and knowledge on the left-hand side. We're all interested in the advocacy piece. What are we going to be advocating for in terms of health gains? And how much capacity have we got, both as organisations internally and externally as a professional workforce? So the model works for me. And so we've been spending 12 months on this. And when I first met with Joe Nurse and talked this through, there was a real meeting of minds here. And for me, it works incredibly well. At a global level, our membership cuts across 57 countries outside of the UK. So our members will train very often in the UK, and then they will go back to countries that they want to work in. And we have 400 members who are based around the world doing that work. We want to use that membership to help us build capacity, to improve our access to knowledge, to increase the profile of public health. We want them to help us deliver the strategy. And more importantly, we see them as a really important part of our capacity in influencing at a sub-regional global level. So we've established special interest groups that will work across Africa, across Europe, across the Pacific. We're just about to set up a new one for India, Pakistan. At the moment, we are undertaking examinations. We run an examination program for Hong Kong. We want to extend that. We're doing workforce development in India. We're looking at curriculum development and training programs in India, particularly working with DFID and the Indian Association for Public Health. And we want to do that capacity building in partnership. We're a relatively small body, but we have a lot to offer, I hope. So in terms of summary and discussion, I'll hand across to John to put that funnel back out there again and talk a bit more about some of the work that we've been doing. But you can see that there are very often similar models, similar emphasis. Where I think we want to avoid is having different models, different emphasis. We need that common language, as Ehud has said, and we need to collaborate on that search for unity. So I'm happy to take questions afterwards, but I'll hand across to John.
So thanks, David. I'll just make some fairly random and tangential comments that hopefully will bring it to life a bit. The Faculty of Public Health is like a college for professional development of public health specialists in the UK, and as it was said at the introduction, we're a faculty of the three medical royal colleges of London, Edinburgh and Glasgow, but it's not confined to medics in the UK now. The careers in public health, including the top jobs in public health, of being a local director or a regional director, are open to people from a wide range of disciplinary backgrounds. And we have two functions. We have the function of professional development and continuing professional development and the curriculum and exams and so on. But we also have the second mission, which is about being a effective voice for public health to government and to other places. I'll make a number of points, really. I think my cousin, who's John Ashton, was the British government's global ambassador for global warming for a number of years. And when he left that government position, he, together with other ex-civil servants from around the world, formed a new NGO called E3G, which stands for Environment of the Third Generation. And essentially, it was about getting in the environment onto everybody else's agenda. And I think one of the things that we need to do is have a public health third generation, where we're getting public health onto everybody else's agenda. So one of the tensions that we have with this model, and I think the model is very helpful, is the danger of it being taken off in a professionalistic direction, when actually, you know, for the last 30 years, what we've been trying to do is move away from having high priesthoods of public health towards engagement with citizens, co-production, asset-based approaches to health development. And so we have to bear that in mind. I think the the beauty of something like this is it takes something very complicated and gives you a simple reference point. And I think, you know, referring back to the World Health Organization's Alma Ata Declaration on primary health care and the emphasis there on several measures of public engagement, intersectoral working, and reorientation of health systems, that was the beauty of that work, because it gave us a simple reference point for where we needed to go. And although some people tend to be critical of the WHO's work in the past, I think that has driven a lot of health development and policy work around the world since 1977, since the Alma Ata Declaration and the Health for All by the Earth 2000 strategy from 1981, which also has done the same thing. But I mean, I haven't got time to go into it now, but I think we do need to situate this kind of initiative within a historical perspective and understanding. If you look at, I come from Liverpool, we had the first medical officer of health in the world, William Henry Duncan, appointed in 1847. Jerry Kearns, who's a public health historian at Cambridge, used to be in Liverpool, but he's a specialist on Duncan's letter books and his records and so on. But Jerry Kearns said that essentially the work of Duncan in the middle of the 19th century could be described in three things, which was registration, notification, and advice. That's what they did. It was generic infrastructure for public health. In the evolution of training and a proper workforce for public health, and I imagine it was similar in North America to the UK, but from the 1840s, it was 40 years before there were any courses to train people in public health. Essentially, they made it up as they went along. They were physicians in the early days in the UK, responding to what were essentially environmental issues, slum improvement and so on. And then, of course, later on, the hygiene movement came in around the 1880s and so on. But the first formal courses weren't until around the 1880s with Dublin, Cambridge and Liverpool, which developed diplomas in public health. So that for the first 40 years, it was all informal, what we call in England learning at Nelly's knee. It was kind of apprenticeship format and so on. And I think, as we've seen the evolution of public health around the world over the last 150 years, then it started off very generic, very pragmatic, and it's become more and more specialised and more fragmented. So this challenge of bringing coherence in a postmodern, fragmented world, where we've inherited in the UK, did David say, 10 different organisations with their own structures that, you know, are standing on the turf, occupying pieces of the turf, where there's often jealousies and rivalries and things like that, which introduces dysfunction into being able to respond in an appropriate appropriate way. So I think having a reference point, becomes important. I haven't got time to talk at length now, but I think one point I would just make is that you can finish up with a great shopping list of things in public health, and in a way, what you need is to apply Occam's razor to that shopping list and have the most parsimonious explanation. It always seems like a contradiction to say the most parsimonious. It's like my favourite bumper sticker is, we need more homeopathy. Think about it. To have simplest descriptor so that we can use it as a template against which to test what it is we're trying to do. And again, remember, people write great big textbooks about things when they're not understood. When things are understood, you get down to E equals MC squared, it really understands it. So the insight into simplicity. So David said I'd mention Ebola. I think one of the things about Ebola for me is that You know, notwithstanding, you know, this last 6 months, people have been immersed in the urgency of the acute situation and the initial clinical response to the situation. That if you are, as I imagine, you know, people in this room are, somebody who brings to bear the full 360-degree public health perspective to bear, then you immediately see this is a case study in classical public health, which will start with the clinical intervention, but very rapidly has to move upstream to all the infrastructure issues, all the slum improvement, economic development issues, the social and community development issues. And it really is a rerun on a big scale of the sort of challenges that were faced here in the cities of the United States in the 1840s with cholera, and in Europe with the slums, and where the preconditions were there for epidemics to take place, and where everybody has a part to play. And the big issue is, how do you mobilise all sectors who've got a part to play? So to take it back to us as a professional organisation with 3,300 members, with a wide range of expertise, skill and passion about things, as president, I see my role as being to provide leadership, if you will, to challenge people to say, what's your contribution to this? How can you play in? So we've got our members and fellows at the moment working within Public Health England, which is the National Public Health Agency now, who are either in the process of going to Sierra Leone, or they've been working in London developing the laboratory logistical support to the treatment centres that are in the field. We've got folk who are going out clinically, a lot of whom I think are public health people, but very often they haven't actually had a formal public health training. They're people who are humanitarianly orientated, and perhaps over the last 20 years they've worked in different parts of the developing world. They've gone and done a diploma in tropical medicine at Liverpool or London, and they've perhaps done an MPH, but they're ready to bash off at a moment's notice and get involved somewhere. And for the last 2 months, I've been interviewing, working through the 1,000 volunteers that we've got from doctors and nurses in the British National Health Service who want to go to Sierra Leone. We've been interviewing them to decide which ones to send and which ones aren't really suitable. So, you know, there's that part. But the next phase for us is about how the partnerships need to develop with other agencies about the next stages of what happens in Sierra Leone in terms of the community development, the social care, the orphans, the slum improvement, the healthy cities approach, I think, is totally relevant to what needs to happen over the next year or two to take the crisis as an opportunity for healthy urban development subsequently. And I think the final point I'll make is that, you made the point at the beginning about in an emergency, people come in, throw resources at it, and then disappear. And so you don't learn anything for the future. And what needs to happen is, of course, that you need to culturally embed the lessons so that the capacity is on the ground to deal with the situation people themselves in the future. And you see, if you look at things like teenage pregnancy, we shouldn't have to keep on putting a lot of effort into sex education generation after generation. If we get it right, then future generations will get the sex education within the family and within the school. But the reason that we're having to do all this work on sex education is because we haven't embedded it within the family unit. And it's the same with disasters and emergencies too, that places that are accustomed to natural disasters, the resilience is there. It's been acquired, it's culturally embedded, people know what to do. It's when you get something out of the ordinary that people are thrown out of kilter. So just to try and bring it back, I would say that, you know, the framework is for me, it conforms to Occam's razor. It's a simple and elegant way of expressing something very complicated, and which then we can each use that in our own cultural context in our own country to say, well, what are the issues for us?